Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnanam Jana Shalakaya Taksurin Mulitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobishtam Tapitam Yena Bhutale Shayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Sapadantikam Pancha Kaupa Terubhyascha Kripa Shindu Bhayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Nama Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasade Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ramo, Hare Ramo, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, greetings from Newburgh, New York. Many of you know the Lovell family, who hosts many wonderful spiritual festivals, and I arrived yesterday morning from early in the morning from India on a direct flight, and now I have an opportunity to apply in a different context the things that I was studying and practicing in India, and I'm looking forward to that. And on Tuesday, on the Gaura Purnima Festival, the appearance of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, I'll be in sanctuary for that class at midday about Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So this is starting a new subject in our Wednesday night Sangha. If anybody remembers the date when these classes began, time flies. I believe it's already been 3 years, and so many books and subjects have been covered. And this is a little bit of a different subject because generally I concentrate on texts within the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, which extends extends the Bhagavad Gita, which is commonly accepted as authoritative within all traditions. And within the modern context of the school of someone just came on. You have to mute your phone. Start tripping. Thank you. At least within the school of yoga, at least the modern context of yoga, certainly Bhagavad Gita is one of the main texts because it does study. It does also discuss yoga. And the Yoga Sutras are also, Patanjali, are quite prominent. It's interesting, there has to be a hetu or a cause. There's a reason why I'm discussing this text. And generally, I teach what is inspiring me at the time, and which I feel will have relevance to others. I got an advanced copy of a translation and commentary of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, with six commentaries, which was quite unique. The translation and commentary is unique in itself because generally you either have translations and commentaries that are kind of geared towards the modern audience, but lose the richness of the scholarly tradition in which those translations and commentaries are born, or you get a scholarly tradition which doesn't very well bridge with the modern audience who is interested in the subject. But the translation and commentary that I got, it's not published yet. It should be published this spring. And I will tell everyone how they can get it. I recommend it highly. It's by Professor Edwin Bryant. And this particular edition, he's both a practitioner for many, many years, a serious practitioner, and also quite a renowned scholar. And he's a deep personal friend of mine. We lived in the same ashram in India and became became friends in the early 80s. And we remain friends to this day. And he's gracious enough to offer his home, which is more or less like an ashram in Princeton, anytime I want to retreat. And he shared this with me. And the reason that he himself undertook this translation and commentary is because he felt the knowledge was so relevant to himself as a practitioner. So he shared it with me, and I kind of had an aha moment. How do I describe that? But when someone, through your own frame of reference, expands your knowledge, you become very much enlivened, enthusiastic for that teaching and subject matter. And so when I started to discuss, and it's so clear, and I, as soon as the book is out, I will let everybody who's on the Sangha know how to get it. I recommend it highly. It's wonderful. But when I got it and I started to reading, I saw it was so helpful in my own spiritual practice. Because, it dealt with the mind. And it's a real deep science of the mind. Of course, it's also found in Bhagavad Gita, another one of our texts of our tradition, the Bhagavad Purana, and the third chapter, Kapila Dev Sankhya, is also very, very much contains a lot of the knowledge. When you hear something also from another angle, a different perspective, it kind of sharpens your understanding. And that's the purpose of study, and especially study from different angles, different perspectives. It's described that the mind is like an axe that can cut illusion. But the axe is sharpened by hitting it against a stone in different angles to sharpen it. So when you study things from different contexts, it really increases your understanding. And I felt it really increased my understanding of the mind. And the mind is so pivotal, as it says in the fifth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the mind can either be the friend of the conditioned soul, or it can be the enemy of the conditioned soul. In other words, it depends on utility, and utility depends on knowledge. So when you have knowledge of something, you have knowledge of its utility, you can use it better. And it's so profound. Even when I came in from the India, it's a 14, 15-hour flight direct, graciously picked up by Gopishore at 4:30 in the morning, and he took me to his house, where I took a little rest. His wife cooked breakfast, and of course, they have four children, and triplets, and then an older child, young children. I was watching the children, and I understood, wow, You know, because I understand the nature of the mind and how impressionable it is. Beautiful statement that I was reading in these sutras that that attachment is memory of pleasure. And according to the memory of what you get pleasure from, whether it's good or bad, that's what you'll seek in the future. So I was watching this child, and I was seeing just the importance and the of raising children and the subtlety, and then looking at the nature of the world that people will grow into up and the impressions that it will make. But really, to understand why it's significant to study, I think, Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras, you have to understand who is Patanjali. And what Patanjali did was, it wasn't that he discovered, you know, or created the yoga philosophy. The techniques of using the mind to free oneself, actually, from the mind. And that process of meditation, how the mind works, it was within already the framework of India, and it was already appropriated by different of the major philosophies of India. So what he did is kind of make a bring it into one book, basically. He kind of studied it from different perspectives, just like the six Goswamis, who are our predecessor teachers. And one of the reasons we glorify them is Nana Shastra Vicharanaika Nipano Sadharma Samstapako. What did they do? Nana Shastra Vicharanaika Nipano Sadharma Samstap. They studied, expertly studied all the vast literatures, Sadharma Samstap, to establish Sadharma, to establish the appropriate things for you to do. Everyone has, in every circumstance, you have choices to make. And if you appropriately respond, there's actually a science to appropriately respond to your environment, your situation, your destiny. And if you respond in the appropriate way, and responding in the appropriate way is called Dharma. There's a science. In Indian Shastras, it's about Dharma, duty, the appropriate response to the world. And if you actually know that science, the appropriate response to the world, then your consciousness becomes elevated. So Patanjali, Nanasha, he studied various Shastras, etc., and he made a compendium of knowledge about how the mind works, and how you can best utilize the mind for your ultimate liberation. And what this concept is with practically within Indian all schools of thought, that there's two basic things: there's prakriti, which is there's matter, and there's purusha, which is the soul. And somehow or other, the soul is entangled and identifies with matter, and it has to extract itself. Because the vikara, or the transformations, are happening in matter. Janma, mrityu, jara, vyadi, dukkha, dosha, an intelligent person, it says in Bhagavad Gita, is birth, death, disease, and old age. It's transformations, but it's actually happening in matter, because one is identifying with that, he suffers. And therefore, to extract oneself, there's different schools of thought, how best to extract the soul, which is pure consciousness, from its identification with matter, which causes him, you know, to suffer by that identification. So how to extract oneself. And there's basically, there's gyan is one way. Gyan is you or sankhya. Sankhya means that you count, you analyze, and you understand. By analyzing very carefully the different elements, you can understand that the consciousness of the soul is different. And then there's yoga is basically the practice of how to do that. Or not the practice, one is the analysis, but yoga means when you actually, it's a mental process by which you can actually extract yourself from that. So I kind of thought it was really, it really helped my own spiritual practice and it increased my understanding. And I thought for this Sangha that it would really be important. It could be really important because we've been meeting now for 3 years discussing and reading through different shastra, different spiritual books of knowledge from different angles. And I thought that this would be a really, really appropriate subject matter for us to discuss now. And I see also that the benefit, when you study things from another perspective, at how it deepens it. For example, I was mentioning that in Patanjali Sutras, one thing I thought was very interesting is that when you actually understand what yoga is, what they actually mean by yoga, it's a deep, dispassionate concentration of the mind that enables one to purify himself and ultimately transcend his attachment to the body and the mind. So Patanjali, I'm just going to, this is a little bit ahead, it's very interesting. He says, before you can actually do that, you should practice Kriya Yoga. Kriya Yoga means the yoga of action, and it's a practice by one, by performing austerities, tapasya, but swadhyaya, which is study, and Ishvara Pranidhan, which is worship of God. So just show you how studying this particular subject, how it relates even to my own practice. So when swadhyaya, or study, very interesting. It's said that there's a fruit of the perfection of each of the activities, each of the practices that you undergo, whether it's yam or niyam, which is the restraints and the observances, or the asanas or the pranayama. But there's a fruit, and the fruit of swadhyaya, if one actually undergoes the proper study of the shastra, the scriptures, it will establish one's relationship with God. It will establish one's relationship with the form of God, which is God manifest to one. So that's the benefit. And then I actually thought that, yes, this is actually what any study does. And it also defined that swadhyaya, besides study, is japa. And then I understood how significant this is as the core spiritual practice. Because when you delve into our own tradition, it says that when you chant japa, you have to actually perfect japa, and the perfection of japa is prema, pure love of Godhead, that the way you perfect the japa is when you chant that japa with an understanding of one's relationship with the divine. So I understood that although I'm studying it from the perspective of Patanjali, that he's perfectly describing what is the essence of the spiritual practice which I'm undertaking. Because that's the benefit of swadhyaya, and swadhyaya means study and japa, and the two are connected. Because you have an understanding of your relationship with the divine, but that understanding of the relationship of the divine has to be applied to your spiritual practice to understand the divine. So in this way, I found there's many, many relevant points that come. As Patanjali is not so much, the Yoga Sutras are not really so much promoting a particular theology, but it's a generic, a psychosomatic practice of purifying the mind. It's something that's actually appropriated with most schools of Indian thought. and it has relevance to a person's practice in any particular yoga or spiritual practice. Now, just a little bit about the course, and then I'll go into the subject. I was at places today and yesterday where I didn't have access to the internet. I said I would send an outline, so I couldn't do that. So I'm sorry about that. And the commentaries that I'm reading on the Yoga Sutras, they're very, very detailed, and there's a great deal of information. So as I go along, I'm going to develop, exactly how I'm going to present this with your help. And I won't be able to give all the detail, but I'll try to extract the relevant points, I'll try to develop all the relevant points of each particular sutra. As I come from a Vaishnav context, when necessary, I'll present the subject matter as it's presented, and if there are any differences, I'll also present what they are. But basically, the differences are very, very minor. For example, when it describes the how from Prakriti or matter, the world is expanded. In the yoga philosophy, the first expansion is Buddhi or intelligence. In the Bhagavad Purana, it's Ahankara or self-identity. So there's minor differences, and that can be presented also. Also, I asked Mahamuni to attend the Sangha because he's in the university and he's very much studying these subjects. In fact, he's writing his thesis on one of the schools of Indian thoughts, and to do that, you have to study all the schools of Indian thoughts. Okay, so now let's begin. Okay, first of all, the title is Yoga Sutra. Sutra is, it's yoga. It's a philosophy. There's six Indian darshans. Darshan means philosophies. There's yoga, there's Vedanta, Vaisheshika, there's Nyaya, there's Mimamsa. I don't know if I mentioned them all, but we'll get to them later. But there's basically six. And these were categorized, not necessarily in the Vedas, but these were different ways that people approached spiritual life. And eventually they were categorized into six. And one is yoga. And generally those subjects, they have sutras. Sutras are aphorisms or codes, because there was so much knowledge and so much meaning, and it was carried down in an oral tradition. And for the purpose of memorization, kind of like bullet presentations of the subjects, different schools of thought, they had sutras. The sutra means it's a short aphorism of code, which has volumes of meaning. So if you learn the code, then it's very, very easy to unpack the meaning. Just like in Vedanta, in the Vedanta Sutra, Vedanta is one of the schools of thought. And in Vedanta, it begins with Atato Brahma Jigyasa. So there's so much meaning. Atato means now. Now indicates urgency. Now that you've come to the human form of life, Pramanda Brahmate, Konya Bhagavan, Jeev Guru, Krishna Pasadi Paiva, you're wandering from universe to universe to speak. Now that you've come to the human form of life, now it's a demarcation. It's very significant. It also indicates urgency. Kamara Acharya Pragyo Dharman Bhagavataniya Dulabham Manasan Jadma Tarapya Dhruvam Tarapya Dhruvam Artaram. Dulabham Manasa Janma, the human form of life, Manasa Janma, Dulabham, it's very, very rare, It means it's something that's rare, has to be cherished and used properly. Dulban manasanjama tat apyat dhruvam artadam. It's a dhruvam, it's temporary, but artam has great meaning, it has great value. It's temporary like all other species of life. But artadam, it has great meaning. Why great meaning? Because one can inquire, one can understand. So atato, now. So Brahman means God or reality. Jigyasa, inquiry. That's the difference between the human form and other forms of life. So these sutras, Jadma Yasya Yataha, describing it as him who everything else is coming, there's so much meaning in them. And therefore, the people who represented different traditions, they traditionally made sutras where all that knowledge is codified. So Vedanta Sutra has 195 verses, but it only has 700 words. So you can understand kind of the genius to put such a depth of philosophy in 700 words. Sutra, I actually spoke to Pradyumna, who's a great Sanskrit scholar, this morning. And sutra, the word su, in English is so. And what do you do? So means thread. So su, the word, the sutra, actually means a thread. The thread. Matat paratanam nanyat kinchit asti dananjayat. What is that? Everything is resting on me, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, like pearls are resting on a thread. Thread also means the theme. And what is the theme? The theme is a statement that in a particular work or a particular essay or a particular book, it's a one statement where every other thing is connected to, even if apparently unrelated. Every book has a theme. So this thread, this is the thread. This is the essence that will connect everything else in yoga philosophy. And therefore, to understand the sutras, there has to be commentators who unpack the meaning. It's assumed in every tradition. You need teachers or commentators. Otherwise, they won't have, you really can't understand that. It's basically, then the teacher explains them to you, and then he kind of, then you get those sutras, and they have meaning. You understand what's packed inside of them. You understand how they expand. So this is the yoga sutras. And it'll cover, in 700 words and 195 verses, it'll cover all the knowledge about yoga. And therefore, Dr. Edwin Bryan, he's translating, and also his own realizations and his own understanding as a scholar, six commentaries on that. And I have access to that, and hopefully in 2-3 months, you'll also have access to them. And the first commentator is Vyas. Now, it's not certain that this was the Vyas, the original editor of the Vedas. Vyasa Dev, Vyas means editor. Deva means godly editor. The Vedas were, what is the Vedas? Vedas means knowledge. And again, what is knowledge? Knowledge describes the utility of things. So it's understand that in Indian tradition, that with the creation of the world, the same breath that creates the world, there's a manual for it. The same breath that creates the world, God said, let there be light. So from sound, the world manifests. From that same sound, the Vedas manifest. And the Vedas give utility or meaning. And the history of the Vedas is that it's one subject, but very, very increasingly difficult to understand for people, and therefore there's Vyasadeva. He is godly, empowered editor, and he divides it into four categories and then takes those four categories and then illustrates it in story form. That's the Mahabharata. And then he codifies it. That's called the Vedanta Sutra. And then he writes a commentary on it called the Bhagavad. So whether or not that's the same Vyas or it just became a common generic name for someone who's a great editor, that's not known. But the main commentator on the Yoga Sutras is Vyas. And then there's other commentators, and all commentators follow his particular analysis of it. So this is actually Vyasa's commentary on the Yoga Sutras. Now, we'll just analyze the three words in the first yoga, the first sutra, Atta Yoganu Shashanam, which basically means now the teachings of yoga are presented. So again, the first word is atato, and this is a very declarative word. And for, of course, again, the urgency, that now this subject matter is important, and this is standard, as I mentioned, for authors of all philosophical works to distinguish specifically what their undertaking is and to differentiate it from others. So he starts, and this is just standard introduction. And therefore, the standard introduction happens in the first verse. Vedanta Sutra, Atato Brahma Jigyan. Now, this is inquiry into Brahman, Vedanta Sutra. So this is now will be the teachings of yoga. And in other words, this teachings of yoga, the science of how to use your mind to reach ultimate perfection. It's the utilization of the mind, the understanding of what the mind is and how to use the mind to actually purify oneself and become and achieve some level of perfection. So this is standard. And generally, yoga is generally, they link, the six schools are linked together. There's six darshans or six philosophical schools. So yoga is generally linked with Sankhya. Sankhya is the philosophy, and yoga is the practice in a general way. So he says all, so basically when you say atta, now that you've studied others, basically the schools say, now here is the, you know, here is the ultimate. It kind of like that. So atato. So atato, and then yoga, atata yoga, anu shashanam. So yoga will be discussed. So this is what this book will be about. Now we'll discuss yoga. Yoga here means, it means generally sometimes yoga is indicated to mean to link with the Supreme. You have different ways. Karma yoga, to link by work. Jnana yoga, to link by knowledge. Bhakti yoga, you know, to link by devotion. But here yoga means something else. Yoga, when the word is used by itself, means samadhi. That's the goal of yoga, is a fully concentrated mind. That's the what yoga means. And by concentrating the mind, then you remove all obstacles to perfection. And that's going to be discussed in the next verse, yoga chitta vritti nirodha. What does yoga mean? It means that basically you stop the fluctuations of the mind. And even the definition, what is when someone performs tapasya or austerity, it means you stop the irrational impulses of the mind. Even in the bhakti tradition, one of the most significant verses, Sri Chaitanya wrote 8 verses. The first verse begins, right? It begins with Chaito, Darpana, Marjanam. So what is Chaita? Chaita means the mind. Chaito, Darpana, Marjanam. Marjanam means to clean. Darpana means the mirror. So the classic is that you'll study, the mind is like a mirror. And when the mirror becomes clean, you can see yourself. So it's understand that the soul, its lens to see the world is through the mind. But when the mind has dust or the mind has dirt, then it seems that the person who is looking in the mirror that's dusty, he also has a distorted image. So the process of yoga means to bring the mind to a very, very pure and clean state, and then one, the soul can see itself. So that pure state is the state where the mind is fully concentrated and is neglecting. If the mind is focused, that's meditation, you're focused on something, and you're neglecting these impulses. And what are these vrittis, or these fluctuations? And what are these fluctuations? They're distortions of the mirror of the mind. And as long as those distortions are there, the pure soul will see itself in a distorted way. And it won't understand its true nature, and won't be able to experience its true nature. So yoga means samadhi, a fully concentrated mind. Later, in the Patanjali Sutras, he'll mention different ways to achieve that. He mentioned Kriya Yoga, that before you can actually become concentrated in mind. This is also mentioned in the 3rd chapter of Bhagavad Gita. You can't start with that process of concentration, because the mind has too many fluctuations. You have to purify the mind. So he describes, how do you purify the mind? So Kriya Yoga. You perform some austerities, swadhyaya, you study, and you chant japa, you worship God, etc. Then he also mentions Ashtanga Yoga, that there's a process, there's a process of gradually concentrating the mind. And that process becomes progressive. First, you have to start with restraint. Your dealings with others. That's the first thing is yam. There has to be restrictions in your exploitation of others. You have to be nonviolent, for example. Otherwise, the mind becomes completely distorted. You can't concentrate at all, as long as there's not restraints from gross fluctuations of the mind, where there's the epitome, there's the how do you put it, the grossest manifestation of ignorance, which is self-centeredness to the point of exploiting others. If you're on that platform, if the mind is so distorted, And then from yam or regulation, restraints, then there's observances, not in how you deal with others, how do you deal with yourself? And then asanas, further purification of the mind. And then, because if the body is disturbed, then the mind's going to be disturbed. So if you want to meditate, you have to bring the body to a point where you're not aware of it. And you're aware of the body if you're sick and diseased and full of aches. And, so you have to actually, in this type of meditational process, now that you want to get deeper, you've gone yam, you've regulated how you relate to others, then niyam, you regulated, you know, how you deal with yourself, then now you have to deal with the body, so that your consciousness is not going towards the body. If you want to meditate, you can't be aware. If you sit down and you try to meditate, but the point is the meditation. That's really what yoga is. And then pranayama, the Patanjali also describes that. If you control the breath, you can control the mind. And then pratyahara, then you restrict your impulses. And then the last three stages are internal. Dharana, dhyana, samadhi, which are just increasing degrees of concentration. So this is really what yoga is. It's concentrating the mind. Actually, asana is one part of it. It's become especially prominent in a modern context, and I can see why. I can see in my own life that the world and our lifestyle is so passionate and so disturbing that almost you have to counteract the pernicious effect of the environment first. I do a little bit exercise. It's not the goal. The goal is the meditation. But just to neutralize the effects of the body, which bring you to a meditation on the body, I can see how it's almost you have to do it to counteract it. Otherwise, it's very hard to sit. My practice is japa meditation. It's helped me a lot, but that's not the goal. And so yoga is when the mind comes to this point of being concentrated and restrained. And actually, it's very interesting. Patanjali described five states of the mind. I'm going to use the English translations of Professor Bryan. He's forgetful, wandering, distracted, concentrated, and restrained. So forgetful is there's no, you're just in complete ignorance, wandering. Then distracted means sometimes fixed and sometimes not. It's not yoga. That's not yoga. Yoga is not meditation and then mind wandering, meditation and mind. It becomes yoga when the mind becomes fixed. And when the mind becomes fixed, then the obstacles to yoga become removed. The impulse, it's just such a science. It's very wonderful to understand the science. That whatever you do leaves a memory, a latent impression. And our whole consciousness is filled with these latent impressions. And then they come up. That's what vritti is, fluctuation. You may have a lot of sex desire, but you're not always thinking of it. But something will come, and then it comes up. So so you're distracted, sometimes fixed, sometimes not. So that's yoga. So yoga will mean a fully concentrated mind and the spiritual effects of doing so. Not only spiritual effects, there's mystical effects of doing so. And that's also discussed in the Yoga Sutras. Because if you understand the metaphysics, the composition of this world, you'll understand that everything in this world, both subtle and gross, is composed of this very, very, very subtle strands of matter called gunas. And how they are, the proportions of them, and the mixture of them determine what something is. And he'll actually describe that when one comes to the platform of yoga, it's called somya. When you actually, dharana, dhyana, samadhi, basically you don't go into samadhi immediately. Dharana means you begin to concentrate, and it becomes thicker, that becomes jhana, and then samadhi is when the impulses of the mind are completely restrained, you're completely fixed, and there's mystic effects of that, which he describes also. So now we got a ta, it's a new school. He's going to explain what yoga is, anushasanam, And this means, basically, anu means following or further teaching. So what this means is it's not a new thing. It's not that Patanjali, he created this system. It was something that existed. Anu means he follows or continues, and Patanjali is not the origin. There's a Yajnavalkya Smriti states that the sage known as Aranyagarbha was the original teacher of yoga. Hence, Patanjali is using the prefix anu, indicating it's a continuation, and that what he's done is systematize something that was there already as a practice in different systems. And again, Atato, you know, now yoga, it's very important, etc. And if you know, in the end of the Bhagavad Gita, when it discusses yoga, it has those verses at the end of the Bhagavad Gita where it says, and when the yogi engages himself with sincere endeavor in making further progress, being washed of all contaminations, and ultimately achieving perfection after many, many births of practice, he attains the supreme goal. A yogi is greater than the ascetic, that's the tapasvi, and greater than the empiricist, the jnani, and greater than the fruit of work, the karmi. Therefore, O Arjuna, in all circumstances, be a yogi. So that's, yoga means when you've come to that point of your practice where you're actually able to restrain and meditate the mind. And then, of course, the famous verse in Bhagavad Gita, Yoginam api sarvesham madgitena taratmana shradhavam bhajateyo mam sameyut kamatomata. The last verse in the sixth chapter, which is significant because the first six chapters give a summary of all different spiritual practices, and this is the culmination verse. So Yoginam of all yogis, of yogis, sarvesham of all yogis, Gatena, abiding in me, always thinking of me, anta atmana, within himself, shradhavan, in full faith, bhajate, renders transcendental service, ya one who, mam, unto me, the Supreme Lord, sahi, yukta tama, he's the greatest yogi, Matai is considered. Of all yogis, the one who, with great faith, also abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me. He is the most intimately united in me in yoga and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. So the highest yogi is one who, with Ishvara Pranidhan, one who worships God. This is actually also consistent with Patanjali. A very, very strong argument can be made that Patanjali was a theist. Here's just one of the, well, it's not an argument, but it's a fact. In the observances that one has, you know, celibacy, cleanliness, etc., one of the observances is Ishvara Pranidhan, is worship God. And then what he does is he goes and he takes the benefit of all the different observances that you can do. And also in Kriya Yoga, same thing, there's tapasya, and then there's Swadhyaya, etc. And he gives the benefit of all. And the benefit of perfecting all the yams and niyams and the activities of Kriya Yoga, the benefit of all of them are material, except for Ishvara Pranidhan, which means worship of Ishvara. Ishvara means God or the Supreme. And the benefit of Ishvara Pranidhan is samadhi, which is yoga, which is the perfection of yoga. So in a way, ultimately, I mean, in a very objective way, if you look at the text, in that sense, although he's not dogmatic, but simply by the fact that worship of Ishvara gives the goal of yoga, gives the result of yoga, and the others give material benefit, it's highlighting that. And that's also consistent with the Bhagavad Gita in the last verse, because he says of all yogis, it's very clear, one who worships and Krishna, Krishna is Ishwar, Ishwar Pranidhan. So same thing. Of all yogis, the one who worships with great faith, who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, he's the most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. Okay. Anyway, that was my start for today. Somehow I made it through. Getting off the plane and coming here. Mahamuni, are you there?
Hari Bol, Marsh.
Yeah. Any things you noted?
I just had one question. Often in the beginning of these texts, there are conditions for the kinds of people who are qualified to study.
Yeah.
So, like in the beginning of the Vedanta Sutra, they comment that, you know, all the commentators say that here are the people who are qualified to study Vedanta. And Shankaracharya, I think, says that, you know, if you have the right kind of detachment and austerity, and Ramanuja says that if you're the person who's gone through the ritual portion of the Vedas and understood it and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Who, I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, a lot of us, you know, are aspiring practitioners in one way or another, but the kind of goal of Chitta Vritti Nirodha is extremely daunting.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are the qualifications to try to employ, to try to do the kind of practices we're going to study?
Well, first of all, every practice is based on a goal, right? You can't adopt a practice without a goal. So even in the bhakti tradition, it first describes prema, right? Or bhava, right? And after you understand prema and bhava, what is the goal, then practice means to utilize your senses for the goal. But as far as I can see, and I have to give it, I'm not a scholar in this text, you know. I'm basically going to be studying it along with the group. I mean, although I have, you know, a basic understanding of the subject matter from other perspectives, but how it's actually presented here, I'm not a scholar.
But well, I guess what I'm asking is not necessarily like what do these commentators say, but what is your understanding of?
No, I'm going to explain. But in studying Patanjali, when he describes how you attain yoga, that's why he describes Ashtanga yoga. You can't go to one until you've done the other. So, for example, it begins with relation to others, right? So what is the first yam? The first yam is nonviolence, right? So each one actually leads to another. Each yam leads to another yam, and then when you can perfect those, you can go to niyam. You know, you can't go to anything. If someone is violent, and it's very, very subtle what violent is, because as long as you have, in one sense, to the extent that you have material desires, of course, you're not going to be able to perfect nonviolence. Because as long as you have material desires, the tendency is going to be to exploit others. And that's what violence is, when you encroach on another's rights. And as long as you have a self-centered consciousness, you'll do that. But it's clear, as I'm remembering, because I tried to study the whole thing before I began the class. I was reading like anything in the last month to try to just get a whole overview context. You can't begin yoga, and you have to begin with the first. And each one leads to the other. You can't do pranayama without asana. You know, because if you can't sit straight, you know, and you're just always conscious of the body, you know, and pranayama is a more subtle refinement of the meditation. So without asana and pranayama, in this particular, you can't go to pratyahara. And pratyahara is when you're actually restraining all the mental impulses. And then you can go to dharana, or begin to remember, or meditate. And then, so there is a progression. And also, before he mentioned, because yoga is dispassion and detachment. So Before you do that, you have to purify yourselves of the causes of all distress, which are called kleshas. And kleshas are attachment and detachment, and ego and so many things. You have to purify yourselves of those because that's what impels the vrittis. There's basic causes in the consciousness of the vrittis. So unless you purify yourself of them, it's very hard to do yoga, which is the cessation of them. You just don't start at the point of cessation of them. You know, so there's Kriya Yoga. You have to, if you want to purify yourselves of the vrittis, you have to perform some tapasya. And what's tapasya? Despite the irrational impulses of the mind, you learn what your duty is, what you should be doing. And you practice austerity. In other words, a yogi can't have a life of comfort. it just doesn't work. because a life of comfort means what? That he's matching the external world to his impulses. He's not trying to give up the impulses, but the impulses are manifesting in his environment. So the environment represents the impulses. So it means the impulse. See, how can he be a meditator on that level? So therefore, there's Kriya Yoga. And I should say, in our tradition with Prabhupada, it's very interesting how he tried to bring the devotees to meditation. Because someone questioned me, how come Prabhupada didn't stress more that when people, in japa, Prabhupada basically, you hear that one tape, when people are doing japa meditation, he said, sit properly. But he doesn't go on and on and on about it. And then if someone says, well, you're finding this knowledge so relevant now. But I'm finding it relevant now because I went through the preliminary work. One reason, I went through the preliminary work, which Prabhupada gave in terms of purifying one by activities of worship of God, by performing austerities and living a very simple life and celibacy and so many things and study and so from a pure, I will have to explain how the process of bhakti, I can't do everything in one class, how the path of bhakti, although it utilizes these things, it's also the practice is also, it's not guided simply by these things. These things are within the practice, they're utilized by the practice. They're not the whole practice. But I've seen, there is a progression. I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, I guess what I was wondering was, there's a lot of us in different stages of life and different situations listening.
Yeah.
And I can understand this is going to be a very serious discussion of a kind of, at least at some parts, a fairly high-level meditative practice.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering and you know me, like what my attitude should be in hearing it. Are these things I'm going to try to directly apply, or do we try to apply what's relevant according to our context? The way I understand your answer right now is that maybe some of these things we won't practice until we master some of the lower level practices first.
I don't think the yoga treatise is. A very, very small part of it is the practice. A lot of it is how the mind is constructed, and I think that's relevant to everyone. Because you got to purify the mind. If you want to know to purify the mind, you have to know how it works. And basically how it works is how it forms. And it is very, very relevant. I'm just saying, even from a simple platform, let's say an addict is listening to this class, right? And we're all addicts, right? And what does addiction mean? Addiction means when the memories of attachment within our consciousness are so profound and so pervading that they overpower our intelligence. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That happens from surfing the web to idle talk where someone can't stop talking. To bit different to understand how that's formed, and it's a great impetus because you actually know how. I told you what is addiction? That every attachment has a memory. Every pleasure has a memory. So if you get pleasure from things that are not healthy, you know, like someone takes heroin, he gets a pleasure, but it's ultimately not healthy. It's actually, it's a temporary pleasure that degrades the general tenor of the mind and its happiness, basically. You know, you can have temporary pleasure. There's some pleasures that are temporary. They may be intense, you know, but it's a very short temporary pleasure, but its effect on the condition of the mind is actually depressing. You know, so, and we all know that. So let's say you get pleasure from something which is unhealthy, right? So it creates a memory in the consciousness. So the memory, that's an attachment. And therefore, it's going to be always, it's always latent. It always can be brought up by some association externally, you know, whatever triggers it off, either the object itself or some unhappiness that you seek to counteract, by however the mind works. So then when you try to fulfill it, then there's another memory that's put. Then now the memory is twice as strong. And then, you know, these are called samskaras. When there's a cluster of them, it's addiction. So you can understand. And I don't think the people also listening to this class, you know, generally, I think to some extent they're all practitioners. And I find, generally, the people that listen to this class are somewhat serious. Because, you know, I know many, many people, and there's hundreds and hundreds of people on my list, you know, but how many people have been listening regularly? So it's some sincere desire is there, and it's the effect of knowledge. You know, when we'll study, I mean, it's going to come up soon because the next verse is yoga chitta vritti nirodha. So what is chitta? It's the mind. So it's going to describe there's a description of the mind and the different aspects of the mind. I was discussing with you earlier that, you know, it categorizes the mind basically into manas. And manas basically, at least according to Patanjali, means there's a faculty of the mind that identifies things and ascribes feelings towards them. And then there's buddhi, which basically makes a judgment on them. And of course, if you want to advance in life, the mind has to be controlled by the intelligence. And the intelligence has to be based on some system of knowledge. So what is dharma? You know, you're confronted in the world with so many circumstances. So there's two things. You have to appropriately identify something and judge it. And the nature of buddhi is also will. You know, so what you do is based on your knowledge to a great extent. So increasing your knowledge of the mind, it will help people to make better choices. And I think there's enough knowledge of the mind here that certainly will. And then there may be some descriptions of samadhi and the higher states, etc. Maybe that can be inspirational in a way. You know, Mooney, what do you think?
Thank you very much.
Anything else?
I'm okay, thank you.
Okay. This is the first class. I'm just going to try to get the hang of actually how to present this in an appropriate way. But hopefully. Any other questions?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Gail.
Hi. Gail, Hare Krishna.
Yeah, I was just wondering why it is that the exploitative mood, especially violence, is so opposed to meditation and concentration.
Yeah. Yeah, because because meditation begins with quelling the impulses of the mind. And the grossest impulses of the mind are when the impulses are so overwhelming that they transgress morality to the extent of usurping the rights of others. In other words, there's attachment and there's greed. So you may have attachment. So attachment means there's some memory of pleasure. But there may be some memory of pleasure. So someone has memory of some pleasure, sex desire. It doesn't mean they rape people. You know, it doesn't mean they exploit people. But what does it mean when they do? It means that that memory of pleasure is so overpowering, you know, that it forces one to transgress even Dharma. You know, generally, our attachments are, and Dharma means the appropriate way to, there's a science, the appropriate way of responding to the world. So generally, we have some, ability, you know, in some culture to control ourselves to a certain extent. But when it comes to the point of exploitation of others, it's just indicative, especially violence, it's just indicative of the condition of the mind and the state of the mind. Some scars or impressions of pleasure have just completely clouded one or overpowered one's discrimination. And it doesn't mean, you know, and we do that all the time, right? Some people get angry with others. So it's an indication of the condition of the mind. And, you think of a meditator as a peaceful person, you know, to some degree. And the fact is, if those powerful impressions are in the mind, then when you sit down and meditate, that's what's in the mind. They're pushing, and they're overpowering. So those have to be subdued. So the first thing is, they're restraints. You have to restrain those impulses, because what happens is, if you don't restrain gross impulses, they only become stronger and stronger and stronger. And when you neglect impulses, then they become less and less and less. So it's just a common spiritual phenomenon of how the mind works. If you don't control your... And one of the ways you control the impulses, one of the ways is by knowledge. You build up your buddhi or your intelligence or your discrimination. And by hearing the shastra and hearing something like that, I mean, I can tell you, even myself, by hearing this, and just like I'm a yoga practitioner, and then I'm reading that the first one is ahimsa. I'm just telling you practically how it works for me, and then I began to read about the subtleties of violence. You know, it's not just the physical stuff. You know, it's subtle too, the harm you do others. You know. And then I was reading also that the benefits one gets when and one actually perfects nonviolence. What is the effect of perfecting nonviolence and the effect it has on the environment around you? You know, and then it caused me to introspect, you know, to identify what aspects of myself are there where it causes me to even subtly exploit others, and how can I rid myself of them? Okay, Gail, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mara.
Okay.
Can you just, like, really quickly, I know you said it already, wanted to repeat the six philosophies, Mimamsa, Vedanta, Vinaya.
One class, Mumi is going to describe them, but it's Vedanta, Mimamsa, Vaisheshika, Nyaya, there's yoga and Vedanta. Okay. Okay. Would anybody else like to say hello?
Hello, Maharaj. It's Malone.
Malone.
Yeah.
Oh, Malone. Thank you for being on. Do you know that I'll be coming to Washington? Did Hari Kirtan tell you?
He did. He did. It sounds like it's coming up soon, right, in April?
Yeah, will you still be there?
I will.
Okay. Look forward to see you. Thank you, Malone.
I'm here. Yes, thank you.
Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hi, Krishna Maharaj.
Who's that?
This is Rasagya.
Rasagya.
Hari Bol. It's been nice having Mooney here this evening, listening the class together.
Oh, okay.
And,
I'm really
appreciating this because I'm doing my yoga teacher's training.
Oh, okay.
The translation by Satchidananda Swami. Satchidananda Swami, who started the Integral Yoga in New York.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to look at the, you know, the differences.
Yeah.
I was appreciating the fact that you're doing this at all because I think it's something that all of us are really ready for and hungry for.
Thank you. I know that it's the way my mind works. Is you have to do it, and then you kind of find out how I should present it. Because I have to also, I think it's a varied, you know, audience of different types of people, and I how to present it. You get the kind of the intelligence by doing it. Mm-hmm. That's the way my mind works. So, because there's a lot of information, but how to present what's actually relevant. But, okay, well, thank you for coming on, Rasagya. Thank you. Anybody else like to say hello today?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Govardhan.
Okay, Govardhan. I'll see you on Saturday.
Yes, Maharaj.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna? Hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Who's this?
Gordon.
Hey, Gordon. I guess I'm be coming up to Millbrook sometime. Gary Govardhan wants to have a program up there sometime, and I'd like to definitely see you up there. Thank you. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay. Anyway, we'll do the next verse next week. Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. Thank you all for coming on. Thank you.